All right, we're underway with session 22 of the First Regathering. That's page 160 in your notebook. So let's do a quick review of where we've been. Last week, we were looking at the War of Independence, and we looked at this map on a couple of occasions. The dark black area is the status of the nation Israel at the end of the first United Nations truce. The Arab armies had attacked and squeezed the nation down to the black area, but the nation survived. And even though they were trying to squeeze the modern Israel out of existence, first of all politically, then militarily, they did not succeed. After the first truce, the IDF went on the offensive, and by the second truce had gained all the dark gray area. So the nation had expanded from black to the dark gray area. Then we looked at the fact that the IDF wanted to take the Negev and destroy the Egyptian forces in the Negev. They used a little bit of subterfuge at the Fallujah crossroads, blowing up one of their own trucks as a pretext, blaming it on the Egyptians, using it as a pretext to launch an offensive against the Egyptians. When that offensive was over, the nation of Israel had expanded to the light gray area. And this is the status at the third United Nations truce, from the dark black area to the dark gray area to the light gray area. But they didn't stop there. The main Egyptian force was centered in Al-Auja, and the IDF knew that they needed to get the Egyptians out of Jewish territory, out of Israel altogether. So using an ancient Roman road, they repaired this ancient Roman road, and that was discovered in one of Yigal Yadin's archaeological books, repaired the road and at night, and then were able to attack the Egyptian positions from behind and throw them into a panic. And after a day and a half of fighting, the Egyptians surrendered and began to withdraw out of Israeli territory proper. But the IDF didn't stop there. They continued to take incursions into Egypt proper. And this is the area that they were conquering as they moved into Egypt proper. They were being successful until Britain moved in. And Britain referred to its treaty with Egypt, saying that if Egypt was attacked by a foreign power, they would side with Egypt and protect them. Well, Ben-Gurion and Yigal Yadin didn't want to take on Britain, so they pulled their forces out of Egypt proper. The war was over. So on this map, you see a Google Eye view of Israel. And at that time, the Rhodes Armistice Agreements were negotiated on the island of Rhodes, which is a Greek island. And with those agreements, every belligerent except Iraq signed a armistice agreement with Israel. And remember, an armistice agreement is not a peace agreement. An armistice agreement still says we're at war with you, but we're just not going to shoot at you. A peace agreement says the war is over. Okay? So for many, many years, until Egypt and Jordan signed peace agreements with Israel, all those nations were technically at war with Israel and remain at war with Israel. Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, etc. They're still technically at a state of war with Israel. All right, so this was the United Nations Resolution 181 that was adopted November 29, 1947. The blue area being the Israeli state, the orange area being the Arab state. But by when the Zionists accepted this shrinkage of the Jewish state down to these small dimensions, the Zionists accepted the plan, the Arabs rejected the plan, and then attacked. But by the time the war was over, this was the situation. The blue is the Israeli, the state of Israel. The red is the Gaza Strip, now occupied by Egypt. The orange is the West Bank, now occupied by Jordan. And again, notice there's no Palestinian state. We have the Gaza Strip occupied by Egypt and the West Bank occupied by Jordan. Okay? No state of Palestine exists. That makes sense? But the state of Israel does exist. It's the blue area. All right, then we watched the story about Shula Cohen, the very successful spy, one of Israel's most successful spies, She began her career in 1947 and was a successful spy for 12 years until she was caught. So we saw her story last week in Against All Odds, and it was just a miracle that she survived. And there is a book describing her life, Shula, codenamed The Pearl. You can get it on Amazon.com by Golan and Pinchas. Shula, codename The Pearl, one of Israel's most successful spies. And then we just watched The Miracle of 48. I believe that's installment number 6 of Against All Odds. And we saw some of the personal events that happened to soldiers during 1948. Now that brings us to page 160 in your notebook. And Israel, a member of the UN. So everybody there? All righty. Following the Rhodes Armistice Agreements, Israel's application for membership in the UN, the United Nations, was approved by the Security Council March 11, 1949. Membership itself came in May of 1949, and you have this picture in your notebook, very famous picture of the Israeli flag being raised at the United Nations Plaza in New York. And can you see Abba Iban there? You recognize Abba Iban? Yes. We'll see more of his DVD as well. In those days, admission to the world body was considered meaningful evidence of a nation's sovereign viability. And Sachar writes, as the Israeli flag was ceremonially hoisted in the plaza of the General Assembly building, the Jewish world at large asked themselves whether only 4 years had passed. 4 years, that's all, you guys. 4 years had passed since the Star of David had been identified primarily as the seal of doom worn by concentration camp inmates. Isn't that amazing? The time is so short from World War II to the State of Israel. The rise of independence of Israel, of history's most cruelly ravaged people, transcended the experience even the powers of description. Even the powers of description of case-hardened journalism and social scientists alike. It appeared somehow as if a new law of nature had been born. Well, that's an interesting comment by Sachar, but it was not a new law of nature at all. It was the fulfillment of prophecy, the prophecy of the first worldwide regathering, the first regathering of the Jewish people, what we're studying today. So that's what happened there. That's one of the reasons why it was so astounding. All right, David Ben-Gurion became the first prime minister of Israel. Here's this picture up on the screen. And Chaim Weizmann became the first president of the new state of Israel. And then the first Knesset opens. And this is the Knesset building in Jerusalem area. I must have taken this picture on Shabbat because there's not a car in sight, is there? Everything is pretty quiet, pretty quiet. All righty. Now, the Israel government system consists of a one-chamber legislature. Now, in the United States, we have a two-chamber legislature. We have the Senate and the House of Representatives. But Israel only has a one-chamber legislature called the Knesset. They are elected by ballots cast for party lists rather than for individuals. The length of office for a Knesset is 4 years. Now, a Knesset consists of 120 seats. Now, here's a picture of the interior of the Knesset building. On the floor, you can see the 120 seats for the delegates from the different parties. On the left, you see the speaker's platform for someone who is addressing the Knesset for one reason or another. And then the visitor's gallery is is above everybody, the balcony. For visitors, for the press, etc. Question?
What does that word mean, Knesset?
Assembly, basically. Okay. All righty. Yes.
So is that like our Senate?
Yes, that's taking our Senate and our Congress and putting them together in one body. All right, so each party list, therefore, contains 120 candidates. And the Israeli voter has no right to strike out a name. They can't strike any name of any candidate on the list of his choice. So in effect, the Israeli voter votes for party ideology rather than for individuals. So, for example, if a political party received 50% of the vote, they have thus won 60 seats in the Knesset, and the first 60 people on the party's list then take office. The order of the listing is decided by the party's central committee and the indicated rank of the person as a vote getter. Now, the cabinet or the government is formed by the leader of the political party. That's the political party holding the largest number of Knesset seats. So you don't have to have a majority. You can have maybe 40 seats, but it's just as long as everyone else has 39 or less, your leader becomes the prime minister and forms the government. And that's the point here. The leader of the party then that has the largest number of seats is designated prime minister, and he selects various ministerial colleges. They put the government together. Now, many times, of course, this new prime minister has to cobble together different factions to get 61 seats or a majority in the Knesset. If he can get 61 seats to all vote for the government, then the government is formed. But if any of those parties bolt from their agreement, the government falls and there has to be new elections. Yes? Jewish people are always opinionated. Okay. All right, now the next two sentences are dated. I didn't catch this when I put this notebook together. So the next two sentences you can scratch out. You can just run a line through them. Those sentences read, however, a fundamental change will occur in the system during the next election in 1996. So scratch that sentence out. And then scratch the final sentence. In that election, Israeli voters will begin to vote directly for the prime minister. Just run a line through that sentence. That procedure was adopted in 1996, but it was discontinued in 2001. And so they went back to the current system. So voting for the prime minister directly was only a short temporary change in the Israeli governmental system. Okay, did you cross those sentences out okay? So the next time I do this notebook, I'll make sure they're gone. All right, page 162. 340,000 immigrants. In the 18 months, that's a year and a half, you guys, only a year and a half. In the 18 months following the Declaration of Independence, 340,000 Jews arrived in Israel. And you have this map on page 162. It summarizes the situation. We won't go through it in detail, but notice the approximate number of Jewish refugees. Morocco, 260,000. Algeria, 14,000. Iraq, 129,000. That is a lot of people. Jewish refugees to Israel from Arab lands, May 1948 to May 1972. Actually, this map covers much more than the 340,000. All right. So no influx like this has been witnessed in modern times. Israel issued an open door policy for all Jews. Emotionally, the policy was dictated by the most fundamental of Zionist tenets. They extended back to the biblical promises and forward to the commitment in the Declaration of Independence that Israel, quote, will be open to the immigration of Jews from all countries of their dispersion. In other words, a worldwide regathering. Now, there was another and no less valid explanation for the unprecedented policy. It was the government's acute recognition of the need for an instant population. You know, we have instant breakfast these days. Israel needed an instant population. Why? People were needed to deepen the military's manpower reservoir, to settle the vulnerable empty spaces of the land, to start new agricultural colonies, and to create a modernized economy. This tidal wave of immigration, and believe me, it was a tidal wave, a tsunami of immigration, was by no means motivated by a pioneering spirit. That's what we've looked at previously, these pioneers, the chalutzim coming in. Well, these guys were not chalutzim. The newcomers received little scrutiny or screening. The aged, the infirm, the weary, the disillusioned, they all flooded in indiscriminately, seeking peace and security, not creative adventure. page 163. Airborne transfer of 50,000 Jews from Yemen to Israel. The Yemenites were the first to reinforce their numbers in Israel. The Imamate of Yemen lies in the southwestern tip of the Arabian Peninsula and was the home of 50,000 Jews. Now here is your map that's on page 162, but I've focused on the right-hand side of the map. And down here in the corner, you see Yemen and Aden there in the southwestern corner of the Arabian Peninsula. That's what we're talking about. On this map, 50,552 Jews, Martin Gilbert's map there. Here's a Google Eye view of the Arabian Peninsula, and this is the area of Yemen, and you can see Israel at the northwestern end of the peninsula there. So there's the area we're talking about. Now, concentrated in and around the capital city of Sana'a, they traced their presence to mass dispersion from the Holy Land after the Roman suppression. So the Yemenite Jews, some of them came, saw that they had immigrated to Yemen when the Romans cast us out of the land back in 70 AD, finished up in 135 AD. Other Yemenites feel that their origin was from the Queen of Sheba, who visited Solomon. Their status as Dhimmis, a barely tolerated minority, was the result of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century. So 700 years later, Yemen was conquered by the Muslims. Somehow they held fast to their Jewish traditions and continued to live in an unshakable expectation of the arrival of the Messiah, who would lead God's people back to the land of Israel. Now, with Israel's independence in 1948, life in Yemen suddenly became very, very dangerous. Chagrined by the defeat of Arab forces on the battlefields of Israel, and aroused by the opportunity to loot, bands of Muslims swarmed through the Jewish quarters of Sana'a and other towns, plundering and burning. So departure became a matter of survival. The Jewish agency immediately got involved, and the largest numbers of Yemenite Jews made their way on foot southward to the coast. They were then loaded on American DC-4s and flown to Israel. At the peak of the airlift, known as Operation Magic Carpet, planes were flying round-the-clock schedules, 7 to 8 flights a day, transporting 200 persons per plane load. So here is the map again of of the Arabian Peninsula, and you see Yemen. And so the flight path was from Yemen up to Israel, from the southwest to the northwest. This is the type of aircraft. This is a DC-4, quite a bit different from the aircraft we have now, quite a bit smaller. And inside those DC-4s, people were packed into a cattle car, basically. Look at that. I don't think any one of them has a seat belt. Would you please all fasten your seat belts and stay fastened while we're in turbulent air? People were just jammed on the plane and flown to Israel, as many as they could possibly get on the plane. So there's many, many Yemenite Jews coming into Israel. You're right. Yeah. It looks like a pews, isn't it? I'm sure they must have just pulled out the regular seats, thrown in benches, and squeezed them all in as much as they could. Yep. Question.
How far was that distance?
That distance, I'm not sure exactly how far that is.
The map looks like it's about 1,200 miles.
Think about 1,200 miles. Okay, 1,200 miles. Thank you. All right. 1950, page 164. Western powers guarantee the existing borders of the Middle East. Now, the preamble of the Rhodes Armistice Agreements, and remember it's an agreement with each nation there, each preamble made impressive and encouraging reading. Each preamble stated that it was designed to facilitate the transition from truce to permanent peace. Each preamble endorsed the Security Council injunction against the use of force and affirmed Israel's and the Arab nations' rights to security and freedom from attack. However, in spite of the high-sounding statements, the Arab countries adopted a hostile policy toward Israel. The Arab purpose was a single-minded and all-absorptive. It flatly was committed to the destruction of Israel, the destruction of Israel as an independent state. So I asked the question, has anything changed?
No.
Nothing has changed. For example, this is the Times of Israel, just last month, May 2nd, 2014. In Italy, Al-Aqsa Mosque Imam urges the destruction of Israel. And from the Tower magazine, again, last month, May 22nd, 2014, Hamas chief, we will not make any compromises on the destruction of Israel. Nothing has changed. No matter what the wording was, no matter what agreement they signed, nothing has changed. Now, the armistice agreements were originally to be but one phase of a two-fold effort under the United Nations auspices to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. By the terms of the General Assembly resolution of December 11, 1948, a Palestine Conciliation Commission was established and charged with three major tasks. One, the accomplishment of a binding peace settlement between Israel and the Arab enemies. Two, the facilitation of measures to repatriate and resettle the Palestinian refugees. Three, the formulation of a plan to organize a permanent international regime in Jerusalem. Notice, international regime, not Jewish regime. See, the point is Jerusalem doesn't belong to the Jews. Has anything changed? No. Nothing has changed today. As matters developed, the PCC failed to achieve any of these goals. Subsequently, the Arab nations adopted a fourfold strategy against the young nation. The Arabs attempted to strangle Israel's capacity to survive or grow through the use of one, economic boycott, two, blockade, three, diplomatic isolation, and four, border violence. Has anything changed? No. All of those tactics are still very viable today, only under different clothes, under different appearances. So the region was unstable and ripe for war, just as it is today. So the West took the first decisive action to restore stability to the Middle East. May 1950, the United States, Britain, and France issued a declaration. And here it is up on the screen. Should the three governments, that's Britain, the United States, and France, find that any one of these states, that's Israel or its Arab neighbors, contemplates violating the frontiers of armistice lines, they will act both within and without the framework of the United Nations in order to prevent such a violation. Good words, huh? High-sounding words, huh? The gesture reflected Western self-interest because it was primarily designed to block Soviet penetration into the region. That was the motivation behind it. So it was just kind of a sham resolution. It was nevertheless gratefully welcomed by most Israelis. It meant nothing. It still means nothing. Page 165, the Law of Return. The first Knesset passed the Law of Return in July 1950, investing Jews everywhere with the legal right of immigration to Israel. In David Ben-Gurion's words, here's the quote up on the screen, "This is not only a Jewish state, where the majority of the inhabitants are Jews." Notice, it didn't say where the only inhabitants are Jews, the majority. Israel has never been an apartheid racist state. Okay? It recognized from the beginning that the majority of the inhabitants would be Jews, but not all. It is a state for all Jews, whatever they are, for every Jew who wants to be here. This right is inherent in being a Jew. Again, nice words. How did they work out in reality? For all this impressive language, the Law of Return did not grant citizenship. In 1952, the Knesset passed a nationality law that accomplished that purpose. Under the 1952 bill, Israeli nationality might be acquired four ways. One, by immigration. Two, by birth. Three, by residence. Four, by naturalization. The law of return likewise failed to define the term Jew. Now, the Supreme Court accordingly made its first effort to define the national term in the Brother Daniel Rufasin case of 1958. Oswald Rufasin was a Polish Jew who had taken refuge in a Polish monastery during the war. He became converted. He took orders as a Carmelite monk. Adopting the name Brother Daniel, Rufasin still felt himself Jewish enough to immigrate to Israel to live and to work. And I don't have his portrait in your notebook, but this is Brother Daniel. His Jewish name, Shmuel. His, I guess his Polish name, Oswald Rufasin. You know, Shmuel Rufasin, Brother Daniel. This is the fellow. And you can see there, he's dressed in the garb of a Carmelite monk. He claimed the right of entry under the law of return. That is, recognized by nationality. When the authorities refused him entry under this category, he appealed to the courts. According to Halakha, Jewish Orthodox law, Rufasin was indeed a national ethnic Jew, for he was born of a Jewish mother. However, the Supreme Court ruled that the national term Jew, while ordinarily applied to many who did not practice Judaism, could not, in the language of men, be applied to anyone who voluntarily adopted another faith. So you can reject Judaism, and it's okay. But if you accept Yeshua, it's not okay. Well, just to give you the rest of the story, eventually he was allowed to immigrate and became a citizen through naturalization. So he did become an Israeli. New regulations were added in 1960. Under pressure from the Orthodox religious parties, the definition, who is a Jew, was determined by halakha. That's a Jewish religious law. Namely, a person was considered a Jew if he was born of a Jewish mother or if he had been converted to Judaism according to Orthodox procedure. And that issue is still a big issue today in Israel. The conservative movement and the reform movement will convert people and the Orthodox will not recognize it, because it wasn't done the way they want it done. And so the Orthodox are still battling the conservative branch and the reform branch over this issue. The Orthodox interpretation of nationality remained the administrative law of the land until January 1970, when the Supreme Court handed down a judgment in yet another historic case, the Benjamin Shalit case. The outcome of this case was that the law of return was amended to grant automatic citizenship rights to Gentile spouses, to the children of mixed marriages, and even to adult descendants of mixed marriages. Page 166. Until the Benjamin Shalit case, anyone born of a Jewish mother was considered a Jew. With the Shalit case, the qualifier to the definition of Jew was added. Here's the qualifier, quote, and who is not the member of another religion. That is the phrase which impacts me personally and every Messianic Jew. You are no longer a Jew. You believe in Jesus. That's the point. That's not biblical. That is rabbinic. And that is the law of the land in Israel. Say again? I can't immigrate, no. Not under the law of return. I could immigrate if I chose naturalization or something like that. As a non-Jew, I could immigrate as a non-Jew. Okay, yes.
Isn't there a
I don't know what procedures you went through. I can't answer that question. Yeah. Yes. Well, yes, that's true, but yeah, unfortunately the rabbis don't put authority on the biblical standards. Their authority is halakha, the rabbinical view. So yes, even though biblically it can be either father or mother, the rabbis have decided it has to be a... It doesn't matter. You know, to the rabbis, if you quote, believe in Jesus, you are no longer a Jew. Doesn't matter. You know, to them, okay? Bob? Yes. The halakha, that goes back to Rabbinic Judaism. I don't know exactly when that ruling was passed in Rabbinic Judaism. It's a result of the persecution Jewish people have. Yeah, if a woman got raped, who is the father, the Jew or the Gentile? Well, we don't know, but we know the mother's Jewish, so we'll count the child as Jewish, if the mother's Jewish. But biblically, it can be either. Biblically, it can be either father or mother. Okay. Oh yeah, oh yeah. You can believe in anything as a Jew today and go to Israel. You can,
in as much as you can't believe in him, they right. predicate what they do on the basis of him who within whom they don't believe.
Exactly. In fact, some Jews define Jewishness as not believing in Jesus. Some Jews. I know, it's crazy. I understand. It's crazy. I'm impacted by that. I'm impacted personally by that. All right, let's finish up here. 1978, Dorflinger case. Eileen Esther Dorflinger, who declared herself Jewish, was, in spite of her protests that she had not changed her religion, she's a Jewish believer, she said she had not changed her religion or left the Jewish people. She was declared Christian by Bagatz, that's the High Court of Justice, and refused entry under the law of return on the ground that she belonged to another religion. The criterion was that the other religion, Christianity, would, on the basis of her own statements, of her beliefs, and the fact of her baptism, recognize her as a member of that faith. So baptism is very important in the rabbis' minds. You're still Jewish until you get baptized. You know, you're still okay. Once you get baptized, you've identified with Jesus, you're out. You're no longer a Jew. So that's the point. All right, 1989, Beresford case. Messianic Jews, Gary and Shirley Beresford, were denied their appeal by Bagatz on the ground that they too were members of a religion other than Judaism, even though the State of Israel does not recognize Messianic Judaism as a religion at all. The criterion was that their faith in Yeshua as Messiah, Savior, and Lord included the belief that Yeshua was the Son of God and that God consists of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Which doctrinal points are incompatible with, you might add there, rabbinic Judaism? Rabbinic Judaism. It's not incompatible with biblical Judaism, but it is very incompatible with rabbinic Judaism. 1992, second Beresford case. Bagatz reconfirmed this decision on the same ground, also rejected the appeals of the Speakman and Kendall families to immigrate under the law of return. The court also rejected all three families' appeals that they be granted permanent residence under the law of entry, which is Israel's immigration law for non-Jews. You know why they did that? Because if you're a Christian, you're going to witness. We don't want anyone, any Jewish person convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. You know, witnessing to a Christian is our breath, isn't it? Part of our life, and they know it. And so the Orthodox suspect anyone who is a Christian. So they don't want anyone who has those leanings in the country. In fact, if you go to Sarel and you in any way witness in Sarel, they will kick you out. They'll kick you out of the country just that quick, you know. But it does happen. It does happen. It does happen. Okay, finally, yes. Oh, Sarel is the volunteer, the IDF volunteer program to go to Israel. Okay. The court stated, final statement here, the court stated that the Minister of the Interior had freedom to grant or not grant permanent residence under the law of entry without giving reasons. How convenient. He doesn't have to give his reasoning, but he could not act in a discriminatory way. So if he doesn't give his reasoning, how do you know if he's being discriminatory or not? That's in the sea. Nice little ruling. Nice little ruling. All right, that takes care of it. We'll return to 1950 next week when we come to the airborne transfer of 121,000 Jews from Iraq to Israel. So let me go ahead and pray, and I'll let you guys loose. I've kept you a little over time. And we'll, like I said, we'll return to 1950 next week. Father, again, thank you for this class, this session. Thank you that we see that you are in charge. not only in the big picture, the big generic governments, but you're also in charge of what happens to individuals, like those five IDF soldiers who only had, you know, a dozen bullets between them, and yet you stood in the gap. You wanted them to live. And we think of that tank battalion that was frightened off the main road because you wanted them to live. So you're not only interested in the big picture, but you're also interested in the individuals. And we thank you, Lord, that you're not only that you're interested in those you love, and you are interested in us. And help us never to forget that even though you are a very big God, you also know every individual personally and deal with their lives. Whether they're believers or unbelievers, you're still in charge of their lives. Help us to walk through this life knowing and trusting that truth. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.